Hello from Brooklyn. I'm Brendan Hart, and welcome to Super Cities, a no BS deep dive conversation about the people and trends moving cities forward. All views expressed are my own and do not reflect our sponsors or partners. Let's get into it. On this episode of Super Cities, we do a deep dive with Bruce Bockenheimer, Director of Entrepreneurship at Pace University in New York City. We cover the growth of New York City's startup ecosystem, trends in education, and the role universities play in innovation. Earlier in his career, Bruce worked at IQ Venture Partners, Westpac Banking Corporation, and the Bank of Tokyo. This is a fun conversation. Let's hear from Bruce. We'd like to start with some context. You've been at Pace for 16 or 17 years, I believe. How did you end up in this position?
Yeah, I'm not at all a traditional academic, and teaching is something at a college level, is something that I've long wanted to do or dreamt about, but didn't think it would be possible without having a PhD in doing publishing. And it was kind of an entrepreneurial journey here. So I started out on Wall Street. I graduated with a degree in international management, and my country was Japan. So I was able to read, write, and speak Japanese at a conversational level. And my desire was to work for a Japanese company in America or an American company that does business in Japan, such as IBM. I wound up working for the Bank of Tokyo, trading back in the early 80s. I graduated in 1983. That was a real go-go time on Wall Street. So I worked at the Bank of Tokyo, and then I moved to Westpac, an Australian bank, to do arbitrage. As you know, the PC had first come out, we created some interesting financial derivative products. I enjoyed doing that, but was looking for the next thing. And I wound up leaving Wall Street to go sailing for a few years. So I bought a 36-foot sailboat and sailed from New England down through the Caribbean to South America, and came back to Annapolis, Maryland. Then in Annapolis, I wasn't sure. I picked Annapolis. I had taken a safety at sea course at the Naval Academy and just fell in love with Annapolis. Wasn't sure what I was going to do. Wound up there. You know, trading's not something that really transfers to other industries, right, or even centers easily. I mean, it's really New York in the U.S. London is another money center, or right, Tokyo. So I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I wound up starting a company called Annapolis Maritime Corp. When I was in Trinidad, I discovered that they grow teak, T-A-K, lumber there. And they have it on plantations, and I was able to export it and get it to the U.S. for about 30 cents a foot, and it sells for about $15 a foot here.
Interesting.
So I started this company, taught myself woodworking, and did some yacht joinery. I really wanted to work with my hands after having worked with just, you know, imaginary numbers, sure, for the previous 8 years, and knew I wasn't going to do that forever. An opportunity came by again with the Japanese. There was a government contractor who supplied forensic firearms identification system domestically for the FBI, but they had the right to sell that commercially internationally. Wound up, Japan was interested in the first country in purchasing this. I wound up going initially casually to a dinner. The translator didn't show up. I did some translating. Japan decided to buy this, and the contractor realized they don't do international business, and they hired me to be the international program manager. It was very exciting. Worked in over two dozen countries with, you know, central governments, Japan and China, all through the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Kuwait, Israel, Egypt, South America, Mexico, Chile. And that contract wound up coming towards an end. There were two competing systems, and the government was interested in having a unified system. And I wound up getting a scholarship from McKinsey and Company to do an MBA in Australia. So I went to the Australian Graduate School of Management. That was in the late 90s, the dot-com boom. And while over there, started a company called Stock Central with another student. That quickly grew to be the third largest finance site in the country. We're making a lot of money in online advertising, was offered over $1 million for it within a year. The dot bubble burst, came back to New York. Again, not sure what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Worked for a kind of boutique broker-dealer private equity company called IQ Venture Partners. Some very seasoned executives. The chairman was the original founder and CEO of Citicorp Ventures back in 1967, Phil Smith. And that was a quiet time. The recession 2000, there wasn't really deals getting done. Then 9/11. I'd always wanted to teach, so I started teaching as an adjunct initially at Mercy College.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in Dobbs Ferry. That's where their main campus was. So I taught a couple courses down in the Bronx. Then I started teaching as an adjunct at Pace for a year, but then got a half line and a full line position, mainly to bring the entrepreneurship program back active. The program at Pace was actually formally established in 1979. So what is that? It's like 40-year anniversary now.
Wow.
One of the earlier programs. But it was had gotten a kind of quiet, a dormant, and I started a pitch contest and business plan competition and some roundtable and other events. You know, so I'd been teaching since 2002. The first year was as an adjunct, the second year halftime, and then this full-time position. And the first one in the department without a PhD on this new line that they call a clinical professor, or some people call it a professor of the practice.
Right.
Relatively newer in academia, but I like something Steve Jobs said, you know, in his famous Stanford commencement address, you can never connect the dots looking forward, only looking back. And it makes sense looking back, but, you know, I wouldn't have predicted that looking forward.
Yeah. It's such a rich history to end up being a clinical professor at Pace after those life experiences. That's certainly not a straightforward path. So you ended up teaching, building out, or reestablishing Pace's entrepreneurship program 16 or 17 years ago. Talk to me a little bit about how the New York City, the New York ecosystem, the greater New York ecosystem has evolved since then.
No, it's beyond interesting. I mean, it borders on amazing to me. If you look at New York, you know, obviously it's a huge center. I gave a presentation and they asked, you know, for the main attribute. I said, well, the main positive thing is we're the center of the known universe. And the only negative I could think of is modesty. But no, there's something unique about New York, but it was always a city of big business, right?
Right.
Financial capital, legal capital, diplomatic, you know, with the UN.
Right.
Printing, you know, New York Times, yep. Wall Street
Media.
Journal, all that.
Yep.
Big law.
Right.
All of these retail, Macy's, Bloomingdale's, and there wasn't a startup community at all or an entrepreneurial spark in New York.
Right.
And there was an attempt during the dot-com days, you know, we had Silicon Alley, and that was really, when you talk about more sizzle than steak, I mean, there was some talk, there was some hype, but as soon as the NASDAQ, you know, crashed in, what was it, March of 2000, I think.
Right.
That Silicon Alley disappeared almost overnight. So that wasn't really there. It was just some
surface
hype
level
going thing along with the dot-com boom.
Right.
That was it. But what's really interesting is in 2008, the financial crisis is what I see as a real impetus or inflection point for New York's entrepreneurial ecosystem. And a huge amount of credit goes to then Mayor Bloomberg. What they realize is, listen, our, you know, tax base employment is so dependent on big business, but this is not some cycle change or something. This is a paradigm shift, to use a word from the time. And we have to figure out how to make New York more entrepreneurial, startup, technology, you know, web, et cetera. And, you know, it's to me, it's so interesting that out of this huge crisis, the financial crisis, came what we have now. And now New York is a leading, or in the U.S., number two, you know, after Silicon Valley. And what was it? So a few things. One is that while we thought we didn't have a lot of programmers and tech people in New York, we did, but they were all in the canyons of Wall Street, quant jocks working for hedge funds.
Right.
When the financial crisis did a couple things. One, if you think of like the giant elephant feeding out the, you know, pond, all of a sudden they weren't there sucking up the talent.
Right.
Then they had to cut back. So now this talent is on the street. But also there was this major shift in perceptions, perception of desirability. What's desirable? It used to be my dream is to go work on Wall Street at, you know, Goldman or Solomon or whatnot. Then all of a sudden they became kind of the villains, the greed that's wrecking the world economy.
Right.
And what became cool and sexy? Startups, entrepreneurship. So to me, it's really interesting how that financial crisis was the inflection point or the impetus for New York's change. And it was an incredibly dramatic change. And again, we could get into the details, but so much of that due to Mayor Bloomberg.
From your seat at Pace, how did you experience that change? How did it manifest itself? Did students become more interested in entrepreneurship? Was there a clear directive from City Hall that universities were expected to, you know, encourage innovation or entrepreneurship? Was it a combination, or did it happen more organically?
I think it happened organically, and when you look at it, I'm going to talk in a number of instances about this perception of desirability. Is something desirable or not? And what's interesting is to students, there was also a shift from, you know, I want that job to be, you know, and Pace's legacy is as accounting.
Right.
And, you know, accounting, you get your CPA, you're going to get a job. And we have 100% placement rate for the accounting program, the combined BBA, MBA, and public accounting. You'll get a job. But there began this shift, and not just with students, but remember, their parents also had to believe it. Like, as a parent, I want my kid to take a major that could lead to a job.
Sure.
But the perception of doing something around entrepreneurship, you know, what's, you know, gives you joy, fulfillment, what's your purpose, your passion? And, you know, maybe after 9/11, you know, people began to think about that a little bit more when people saw their father, I would say parents, but a lot of times father being laid off from that big company that they worked their entire life. Maybe some of that idea about I want to work for a Fortune 500, you know, whatever company in Manhattan at their headquarters began to shift a little. But for me, it was interesting because from outside Pace, I was involved in the entrepreneurial ecosystem of the city. So I did have a number of meetings at City Hall, had the opportunity to meet people like Mayor Bloomberg or the Bob Walsh, the head of New York's small business, Department of Small Business Services, other universities. I did a program on the role of, you know, universities in New York City's entrepreneurial ecosystem. But I was also on the board of the MIT Enterprise Forum of New York City for about 15 years. I was a chairman for a couple of years and served on the global board in Cambridge. I've also been on a number of other boards like Disruptive Technologists of New York City. It holds a lot of meetups and organizations, and on the advisory board of some private companies.
Sure.
So began to get the feel for it. And it really is this ecosystems, and universities play a very unique role. Government obviously plays a role. Big business plays a role.
Right. Is the evolution of that, of the New York ecosystem, as you just described it, and the sort of pillars of these communities, universities, government support, big business, experienced executives like yourself, are those standard participants in what we describe as ecosystems in your experience, or does that change from location to location?
There are, and there's models for ecosystems. One is like a Daniel Eisenberg up at Babson described models looking at, you know, government, education, corporations, associations, foundations, support organizations, media investors, financing, et cetera. And, you know, that's an important way to look at it. But I think a couple things to me are outside of those are what's really important. So one that I mentioned before is this whole idea of perceptions of desirability. Does that look something desirable, something I want to do?
Right.
And if you think about New York, like I was here in the mid 70s. I grew up here and it was horrible. Mm-mm. Like nobody, you know, wanted to be the Lower East Side or the right. Meatpacking District.
Right.
Were horrible, right? Right. You know, riot in Tompkins Square. Now it's like the hottest area, more high-end omakase sushi bars than right. Ginza.
Right.
What happened? They're the exact same buildings and same streets. It's not like they bulldozed it over and rebuilt this sparkling new city.
Yep.
It was just that perception of what's cool and what's not. As I mentioned, I went sailing. That was a way to live independently and self-sufficiently and travel. I could have taken an RV, you know, like a Winnebago and driven across the country.
Sure.
Same thing, but the perception of, oh, you bought a yacht and sailed the Caribbean.
Right.
Or, you know, in a way, it's really the same thing, but the perception, same thing with being in New York. The mid-70s, you know, the famous, you know, going bankrupt, Ford, you know, to the mm-hmm. mayor, you know, mm-hmm. drop dead, you know, and just what the Meatpacking District or Lower East Side looked like
right.
versus today.
Right.
And same with other cities. So one really important thing that falls outside a lot of these models is a perception of desirability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Miami used to be, you know, drugs and crime. Now it's right. a great place.
Right.
Cities wane and, you know, go up and down. Another thing is what I would call path dependency.
Okay.
A big mistake is to try, say, oh, look at Silicon Valley. Let's recreate Silicon Valley here.
Right. Right.
And they actually call it Silicon Alley.
Right.
But, you know, what happened there is unique to them. And, mm-hmm. you know, people like, you know, the role that Stanford University and some of the big chip companies and all sure. played there. You don't just recreate that.
Has a unique history.
Right. It has a unique history and a path that it followed
yes.
and unique attributes and unique strengths, right?
Right. Right.
You know, so New York City also has some unique strengths, a lot of talent. And if you look at the startups here, obviously we're not starting chip fabrication companies, but look at all the like shopping and media. Why? That was our history. We have a lot of talented people in that industry and people want to live here. You know, if you start up, I don't want to name another city to insult anyone, sure. but pick a city somewhere else that isn't that desirable now, it's going to be hard to get people there because, you know, human capital, when you're a bright entrepreneur, you could live where you want. Or look at the digital nomads, right?
Right.
They're, you know, living on their laptop on a beach in sure. Phuket or something.
Sure, sure. Can we dig into this idea of perception a little bit? I think this is a powerful point that resonates with me. Who shapes perception?
Yeah, well,
is that a product of media or what we consume? Is it family or community based? How do you think about perception? It makes a lot of sense, but I'm interested in what the inputs to that shape perception are.
No, and again, if you look at the perception of being in New York, the perception of studying entrepreneurship, the perception of working for a startup has all changed. And, you know, as much as, you know, local governments or cities or countries would like to shape that, generally can't. And one of the worst, you know, position you can be in is when someone else defines your brand or defines sure. who you are, and you really can't control it. Because like I look at New York, you know, again, I was here in the 70s, horrible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here now, it's like, great, we have people, universities from around the world coming here.
Right.
Such an important factor. And they're coming to be in New York City. And that could change, you know, some high profile crime, you know.
Right.
You don't know when you can't control that. And, you know, it is really interesting what shapes that. And, you know, other countries are trying to set themselves up as, you know, a desirable entrepreneurial place. You know, Buffalo's doing these competitions, giving out $1 million, right. Startup Chile. What's going on? You know, you've been hearing Saudi Arabia, new digital city, Dubai, you know.
Yeah, right.
There are some, it is really hard. And, you know, there's that old cliche, perception is more important than reality. I never kind of bought that until recently.
Yeah, I think a theme that comes up often in these conversations is fundamental shift from this sort of centralized ecosystem to this decentralized ecosystem. In important ways, being able to start to functionally start a company outside of a New York City or Los Angeles and to be able to attract talent and capital that was very difficult 5 years ago, or much more difficult than it is today. And if that trend continues, you could imagine smaller ecosystems, maybe highly specialized, that offer a different mix, affordability, quality of life, things that New York has a difficult time competing with. That's just optionality. That's sort of market optionality, right?
It is. And, you know, you could run those ads and try to recruit those businesses, but that's not something. Listen, if you want to be in New York, you know, the role of talent is right. So incredibly important. The only basis for sustainable competitive advantage for a company, for a city, for a country is innovation. And the only place that innovation comes from is people, is talent.
Right.
And right now, New York is this global magnet for talent. And, you know, the idea that we're keeping some people out is, you know, incredibly frustrating. And if we don't, other countries will take them. But it's so important. I think people have this misconception like, oh, if I give a good, you know, there's still unemployment. Like if I pay, okay, if the going rate is 100,000, I pay 120, I'll get all the people I need. No, people aren't going to pull their kids out of school, have their family move and get away from what they love, especially if they're talented and could go wherever they want. Now, why they're in New York as opposed to a place that's sunnier by the water or whatever else with lower tax rate, I can't say. But listen, as high as rents are, you know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. And if you're really talented and driven, you're going to figure out a way to pay those rents and do what it takes. So this idea that other cities can attract people by some tax incentives, that's just like one leg of a stool. And I think what's really important for any of these cities, I talked about perception of desirability, and I talked about path dependency. The other thing is strategy, real strategy. You know, it's not enough to just offer some tax breaks. It's not enough to just, you know, say we're going to cut some red tape. Those are important actions. But if you think of strategy, a classical definition of strategy, you know, a coherent pattern of action, interrelated activities or interdependent activities, and some kind of irreversible commitment. You know, these aren't just a couple things you do here and there. You know, cutting red tape or having a friendly government is a leg of the stool. But, you know, if you don't have the other three legs, it's not going to stand up. And it's not only having the other three legs, but that they all make sense in an interdependent way. So I think that's another important aspect. A fourth one that, again, doesn't show up on a lot of these models or in city planners' minds or whatever is, well, I would refer to, there's a book I like by Guy Kawasaki called The Art of the Start. He just published a new edition of it. I think the first one came out 10 years ago. And the last chapter is called The Art of Being a Mensch. A mensch being a Yiddish word that means, you know, giving without the expectation of getting something in return. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other places I've gone, they're more transactional economies. Hmm. You know, you could show up at whether it's a chamber of commerce or whatever meeting and, you know, the service providers are there with their cards. You know, we need an accountant, need a lawyer, need this.
Right.
And, you know, oh, I'll come in and guest speak, but, you know, will I be able to recruit students? Can I get a free intern? You know, and one thing about New York, you know, there's this perception, New Yorkers is gruff, arrogant, tough, pushy, but it's not like anyone that I've asked to come in to be a guest speaker, to be a judge, to be a panelist, they have. And, you know, there is something, even among businesses here, I met some of the people that run like Brooklyn Brewery, Steve Hindi, when other brewers come, you know, there's this idea of being a mensch. Let me, you know, give without necessarily the expectation of getting back. And again, that's a softer thing that I think doesn't show up in typical models of cities and entrepreneurial ecosystems.
Yeah.
But when you combined, you know, those four and then some little things that you don't really think about, like a good airport. Well, why do you need a good airport? Well, intellectual travel doesn't go by rail or sea or car. It goes by airport. You gotta have and a lot of other things like, you know, we think of utilities like electricity and water, but, you know, internet broadband is going to be critical as, you know, a utility. So there's those other little things, but I think it's some of those things we don't often think about that are huge drivers of ecosystems in cities.
It's such an important point. One reason I find universities and the university's position within the ecosystem a really interesting or rich topic is the ability to repeatedly recruit young, talented people. In a city like New York, there's dozens of universities that are doing interesting work in a variety of fields. And New York is a diverse place. People feel like they can come from anywhere and find a home or find a community in New York City. Then I imagine the challenge sort of at a city level is, how do you retain those people? How do you not lose talent after you've educated or developed them? And I know from studying this this dynamic, this is one of the challenges, not for New York per se, but for other ecosystems when they experience brain drain.
Yeah.
Right. Their top people end up building companies elsewhere. That creates its own momentum, negative momentum, of course. But how do you think about, you've developed PACE's entrepreneurial program. In many ways, you've defined the types of efforts, the types of courses and the university's approach to entrepreneurship. And of course, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens relative to other participants, other universities, what the market says it needs at any particular point. How do you think about the unique characteristics of this university, of your approach to entrepreneurship, of what your students find interesting or compelling? And how has that changed over time?
Yeah, no, it's an important question. If you look at the big, you know, startup ecosystems around the country and around the world, they're around universities, you know, mm-hmm. Silicon Valley, obviously around Stanford, Caltech, and all, Stanford University in New York, you know, we have Columbia and NYU, Pace, Rockefeller University.
And the New Cornell Tech.
New Cornell,
campus.
That's a big one. I was going to point to, but, you know, UT Austin or the Research Triangle, you know, Duke, UNC, mm-hmm. even overseas. In Israel, like the role of the Technion. So universities play a really important role for a number of reasons. And it's important and it's interesting to look at what it is. I think one thing, and the most important, is that draw of talent from around the world, the best and the brightest coming to American universities. And you know, it would be a shame to stop that, or when we, you know, grant them a PhD in, you know, some critical STEM field to
right.
send them on their way. But they do a lot more. There's, you know, kind of a neutral convener of things, right? At the university, we could bring in a Microsoft and a Google, you know, competitors. There's the role of research, you know, obviously at sure. research universities. Also, it's interesting that students, alumni, tend to stay around the university. You see mm-hmm. that around the military institutions. You know, if you went to West Point or the Naval Academy,
right.
you know, you go back and maybe in retirement or later.
Mm-hmm.
But like PACE, you know, we have something like 140,000 living alumni. Something like 80% of them live within 100 miles of the campus. So there is right. something, you know, when you go to a university and begin work there and setting down those roots about coming. There's also some interesting thing. If you go back, obviously the you know, the incredible story is Silicon Valley. And the role of, you know, this Fred Terman was, I think, the provost of Stanford, you know, and the research that was being done back around World War II, and how he told, you know, professors, listen, don't just stay in the ivory tower. I want you to go out and work in industry. And that idea about, you know, how are these things really used? How do you commercialize university developed technology?
Right.
How do you work with industry and build on that ecosystem? And things that people might not think of, like the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980 that said universities, and when you got government funding, that you could actually commercialize this, that you could have ownership of the inventions made with federal funding, you know, the patent and trademark reform. And even if you go back before that, Look at the original Industrial Revolution when we went from an agrarian, you know, an agricultural to the Industrial Revolution in the mid-1800s. What did the government say? Well, we need more like engineers for the railroads. So what did they do? They started the land grant colleges,
right,
to create the pipeline of that needed talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, that's happening now. So the role that universities played are multifaceted and, you know, really interesting. And I mean, could be a, you know, a whole talk on its own.
Do you think that legacy of supplying talent that the market needs or demands, sort of thinking about research as applied research, not as sort of static research, will that continue into what feels like an uncertain economic future? It feels like there's a fundamental shift happening within the global economy. It may or may not be the case that a university or a collection of universities are able to adjust course for all of their own equities as quickly as the demand calls.
So not only will it continue, it's going to increase exponentially.
Oh, okay.
And if you look at, I mentioned Bloomberg before, when he looked at all those aspects, the legs of the stool, if you will, of what New York has and needs, one thing he recognized was that applied talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing he said is he wasn't just going to turn to like City University in New York, even though it's the mayor of New York City and they have about a 250,000 to 500,000 students, and at one point had the most Nobel laureates of, you know, any college, city college, or to Columbia, clearly a prestigious Ivy League. He said, I want the best in the world and we're going to have a competition. And that, you know, turned out, you know, the Cornell NYC Tech, because he recognized that's something we need, and that's going to accelerate, whether, you know, machine learning, IoT, like so many things, the demand is going to increase. And colleges that don't adopt will go by the wayside. I mean, we have something like close to 5,000 colleges and universities in the U.S., and, you know, my guess is at least 10% of those will be gone within 10 years.
Interesting.
So if you look at what he did, I mean, you mentioned money and talent. I like Bloomberg said that talent attracts capital better than capital attracts talent. You know, just throwing money at it's not going to get the people. But if you have the bright people, the talent, they'll attract the capital.
Right.
You'll see that in New York. When he was doing the plans for Cornell NYC Tech, I mean, obviously he didn't know it was going to be Cornell and the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology. But, you know, he was criticized. So your people up in Boston said, listen, you know, Boston, Cambridge, that's the university of town, not New York.
Right.
Bloomberg pointed out that New York City has more college students than Boston has people.
Yeah, right.
And
it's a scale. It's an issue of scale.
Scale.
That's right.
And again, that desirability. And it's funny, the perceptions. You know what drove the biggest increase in like college enrollment back in the 90s in like NYU and Columbia?
What?
It was a combination of Friends and Seinfeld. People were watching Friends, you know, the apartment over on Bedford and Seinfeld on the Upper West Side. I want to be there.
Yep.
How could colleges in New York know that was going to drive enrollment?
It's so funny. I've been thinking about this actually recently, how Hollywood sort of fundamentally changes culture for better or worse. And this idea of Silicon Valley, the show, There's a HBO show. It takes this sort of concept that is widely known amongst people who are already interested in this topic and projects it to a new audience, a much larger audience that may or may not be already interested in this concept, in the same way that Seinfeld or Friends highlights what living in New York is.
Yeah.
And the best parts about it for people who may not have considered New York as a viable option.
You know, and Hollywood obviously has a big impact on culture, not just here, but around the world. But, you know, there's flops that they can predict and things that, you know, trends that come that they never saw. So when you asked before about where do those perceptions come from, you know, it's not something that could be controlled even by a force as powerful as Hollywood.
Sure.
And it is, you know, interesting which ones catch and which you know, drive people to change behavior. As I said, that perception is so important. And sometimes, you know, you really have to be honest with yourself while you're doing that. I remembered when I, you know, went to graduate school, everyone's like, oh, you know, you got to go to like, you know, McKinsey or BCG or Goldman. Sure. And like, if people weren't thinking of that before, you know, they never would have. But all of a sudden, if you're told that's what you can't have, you know, I mean, a classic example, it was a course at where I did graduate school, you know, this is a course we want you all to take because we think it's important. What does everyone do? Moan.
Yeah, right.
But what happens when you said, this is a course we're bringing in someone, but it's capped at 20 people. The 100 people in class, well, I paid the same tuition, I want to get in.
Yeah, sure.
But there's all these fun examples, like University of Virginia, they had problem getting people to go in a certain dorm. They called it like, you know, the Jefferson Scholars Dorm. We could only limit, you know, everybody wanted in. So this idea, vain desires coerced subliminally.
Right.
Sometimes you don't know where they're coming from. And it's very easy to get sucked into doing something you don't love and putting in all these crazy hours and dedicating your life to and to impress someone you don't care about.
Right.
So there's, you know, multiple sides of this idea of perceptions of desirability.
It's a fascinating topic. So we're now in 2019, which is hard to believe. Let's think forward a little bit. Where do you see innovation going? New York City going? What will be the sort of defining characteristics, call it, of the next decade of innovation in New York, in the United States, globally? Are there some technologies or some industries that you find particularly interesting or exciting?
There are, but I think it's a big mistake to try to predict which technology. You know, there's all these fads and trends. You know, what's, you know, the internet of things, AI, which is really machine learning. You know, robotics, there's a lot of things. In the end, it's your ability to create value as an individual or as a company or as a city. And there's only two ways to create value. You solve a problem somebody wants solved, or you create a benefit that they want. So if you're able to, you know, solve a problem or create a benefit, you've created value and people pay. So if I were, you know, to give my kid advice, I would say, you know, instead of looking for a job, look for a customer. What is a job? A job is where a boss, you know, you say, tell me what to do and I'll do my best. And in return, I get a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all right, I tell you what to do. You know, you say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. You do your best job possible. In return, you get a paycheck. That's of limited value. And there's a lot of competition and what you kind of can't do changes. But imagine if you think about that, not looking for a boss, but a customer. What exactly does that mean? Like someone who's going to value and want to buy, consume what I have to offer, whether that's my skills as a programmer, as a artist, as a creative thinker, a consultant, an accountant, whatever it is. I think that's what's important. And those skills of what's going to be required in order to solve problems and provide benefits are going to change. So I like to think of a college education as learning to think about how to solve problems that don't even exist yet. What is that way? And realizing, you know, I'm the CEO of, you know, state your name here, and you have to change. And, you know, when you talk about where things are going to go, not only to anyone who's predicting technology is, you know, ignorant or arrogant, that ability to stay focused on, you know, how do I add value is going to be critical, and what skills are going to be needed. And those skills will be different in 5 years and they'll be different in 10 years. So you've got to stay current. And I think there's, particularly with, you know, machine learning, robotics and all this, some really unpleasant things coming. I like to show a clip or a picture of like Woody Allen's Sleeper. You know, he predicts, you know, in the future. It's basically a comedy. But there's this thought of this utopia where, because we've progressed so much, that people are going to be able to, you know, think great thoughts, you know, create beautiful art, do all these wonderful things, and the robots and machines will take care of, you know, manual labor and right. the orgasmatron and right. everything else. But what is really going to happen? I mean, look at our country or any other country. If big companies are doing really well and making a lot of money and displacing workers, how realistic is it that the government's going to say, okay, let's tax these big companies, distribute the money to people that are being displaced by them that can't get a job? I don't think we're going to have some utopia where we're going to have lots of artists and poets and creatives doing things to, you know, advance their self-actualization. I think there's going to be more of a dystopia for a lot of people, and particularly those that don't have the knowledge, skills, ability, and entrepreneurial mindset to say, you know, I've got to, you know, again, create value by solving problems, providing benefits. It's about opportunity, the ability to recognize, analyze, and capture opportunity as an individual, as a company, as a city, as a country. And it's actually a scary time.
It is. It certainly is. I like to think that one of the silver linings in this portrait is that one of the traits or characteristics that will be increasingly valuable is creativity. Is the idea of adding value in new and creative ways and being flexible in one's approach and one's thinking, you know, sort of doing things that the machines can't do.
And machines can't be creative.
Right.
I mean, look at that. They program like every great work of art in history and they ask the computer to draw and it looked like a not even a childish cartoon.
Right.
But that's important. It sounds simple or trite, but again, where are you able to add value? I mean, look, in the past, we went to school, we memorized all these facts. Why? Because if you wanted to find something, you had to go to a library, you know, go pull through the Dewey Decimal System, pull out an encyclopedia.
Yep.
So the people that had all this content were important. But now, you know, with Google, like, you don't need the content. You need a way to critically think and analyze and be creative. And again, what I was saying, the only basis for sustainable competitive advantage is innovation. And the only source of innovation is people.
Yeah, it's such an important point that should be emphasized often. A couple of rapid fire questions, if that's sure. Okay. Where do you go for your news? What are some trusted sources that that you find reliable and informative?
Yeah, one thing I like to do is conscientiously go to different sources. If I'm watching TV, you know, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. And, you know, watching ones you disagree with can be frustrating, but what's important is that empathy. Can you understand
right.
why the people are saying this? Like, it seems absurd, ludicrous. You know,
right.
what are they? But it's important to understand other sources. You know, there's a lot of great sources. One thing I try to do is use Twitter, like, you know, billboards passing when you drive down on I-95, you know, follow people from different news sites.
Right.
But that's not your news. That's like your sorting funnel to go and read that. And and I try to follow people that I'm going to look through all of that. So, you know, it's interesting, kind of the roots of Twitter. You know, I found they said he liked listening to like the police scanners, getting these little
right.
bursts of information, but then going from there. So I found myself depending more on Twitter, like, you know, Facebook. You have to be very, very careful. If I make a point to follow people again on multiple sides and not to unfriend people that write absolutely ridiculous things. But again, think, why are they thinking that? What is
sure.
what is the root cause behind that?
Sure.
And what is a way to empathize and address that? But by that, I don't consider a news site. That's more like just a social weather vane. So I get the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Am I like Sarah Palin? So, you know, and I also try, like I just came out of teaching an international management class. And one of the assignments is they have to do what I call a foreign news article review. So go to papers, you know, the Nihon right. Keizai Shimbun, the Economic Times, the Financial Times,
right.
and look at The Economist and look at other sources of reputable things. I think the role of like ProPublica, you know, what they've been doing is important. But, you know, our democracy depends on two things, a free press and an informed electorate. I think we still have a free press, but I'm a little worried about the informed electorate.
Yeah. But the nature of news, I've come to believe that there's a central tension of basically ad-supported content with subscription-based content.
Yeah, clickbait.
And that monies, you know, who's able to access legitimate news, truth.
No, and if you go back, you know, look at the newsrooms, you know, CBS, Walter Cronkite, NBC and all.
Sure.
The basic premise was, who owns the airwaves in America? Well, the people do. All right, you want a license to broadcast, you know, I Love Lucy or shows, all that. Well, then what you're going to provide in return is news.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a loss. We could put in budgets, we could have correspondents around the world, but that's what we're paying to use the airwaves of America. And that kind of contract is lost, and now it's hard to support journalism. But listen, like any other entrepreneurial or, you know, this idea of Schumpeter, creative destruction,
right?
We'll find, you know, another source. I just hope we find that source and again have that informed electorate, because democracy is, there's no guarantee. It's you know, our institutions are strong, but it's a thin veneer that has to be supported.
And we have to be, all of us have to be vigilant. It takes a vigilant mindset to stay sharp, to make sure that we're actively looking for the best information, even if it's not the most comfortable information.
And how do you critically analyze it? And again, not just, I mean, we've gone into tribes and all that. I mean, I think understanding, you know, why people are thinking and looking at, but also not being complacent, right? The price for freedom is eternal vigilance. I sailed down to South America, to Venezuela. You know, Caracas used to be the most expensive city in the country. It was four bolivares, I pronounced it wrong, for a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
They were a founding member of OPEC. It was a rich place.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, the bolivar was already 40, and in a couple months I stayed there, it went up to 100. Now I think it's between a quarter million and a half a million. It's like 300,000-400,000 bolivars. And, you know, there where you wanted to, okay, I was a boater, keep track of your dinghy outboard, sure. You know, tie it up to the boat at night. Now you'll get killed for a gallon of gas. Forget about stealing your $1,000 outboard.
Right.
And look how quickly that devolved, or, you know, what happened in the Middle East. You know, the institutions of democracy are strong, but there's a degree, and, you know, you could, you know, weaken them. So I think, you know, it's interesting. You know, what happened in Venezuela? What happened in Germany in the 30s? What happened in Turkey and all these places? And, you know, it's not to back into your tribes. It's to say, you know, I'm a citizen and I have some responsibility, if not for myself and my children, but for the people that went and gave their lives for this freedom.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I would just call attention to the idea that this is when we need leaders, right? This is when we need
people, leaders,
including your students, to step up and to participate and to demand, you know, appropriate change and respect for the institutions that you just described.
And leaders, you know, it's also, you know, the people, the citizens. I asked greatly the former president's a neighbor, Clinton. I asked him, you know, for someone else, you know, what's your definition of a leader? And he said, someone with followers. I said, what makes a great leader?
Mm-hmm.
He said, someone with great followers.
Mm.
And we could have great leaders, but we need to also not only take on the role of leadership. It's great to see new people entering
sure. The
fray and picking up and saying, I'll do that. We saw with a, you know, new Congress, but also engaged, active citizens. You can't just wait for someone else to happen, right? Because I like that expression. If you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu.
Well said. Well said. Where can listeners find you online?
If you could spell my last name, Bachenheimer, you can go to Bachenheimer.com, Bachenheimer.com. That's a redirect to my Pace University faculty webpage that has everything.
Okay, wonderful. Bruce, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That does it for this episode of Super Cities. Before we go, some real talk. Cities feel broken, too expensive, too crowded, too chaotic. So we created Super Cities to elevate the people and trends moving cities forward. This movement is just getting started, so please rate, review, and subscribe to Super Cities and tag us using hashtag Super Cities. Your support really helps, and I'm thankful for it. This is Brendan Hart and Super Cities, signing off for now.